Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 118 with Matt Faircloth on leveling up to a 195-unit value-add apartment deal. If you've been listening to the REI Diamond Show for a while, you know that I love having previous guests come on the show to share how they've grown their businesses since the last time we've seen them. Today's guest, Matt, and I have been friends for a while. We met in Miami a few years ago where we were both speaking at the IMN Single Family Rental Conference, attended by many institutional Wall Street residential real estate investor types, as well as us lower volume operations. Matt operates in New Jersey, not far from where I grew up outside of Philadelphia. He was flipping houses, holding rentals, and had done some commercial on a small scale, as well as several new construction deals the last time we talked. Now he's leveled up to doing out-of-state multifamily deals, certainly his first. It's this transaction here that Matt recently made that I highlight throughout this episode because of the fact that so many in our audience here have a desire to do exactly that, transition to larger multifamily, larger multi-million dollar deals. More money, more economy of scale, maybe ego, whatever the reason, we all seem to dream of doing large 100-plus unit multifamily deals or more. So you'll notice that I keep the focus on that transition point here with Matt as we go play-by-play through that 195-unit deal. I dig into his thought process, how he found the deal, how he funded the deal, and how he's now operating the deal to march it down the path to the profit. Well, I think it's about time for Matt to come on and share the details. Let's get to it. All right. Welcome back to the show, Matt. How are you doing today?
I'm really great, Dan. Thanks so much for having me back.
Absolutely. I was looking forward to this episode. It took us a while to circle around and finally get it on our schedule with both of us being so busy. I am recording from Chicago where I live. Just so listeners who maybe didn't check you out before, maybe just want to share where you are recording from, operating your business, et cetera.
Yeah, man, I'm located in Trenton, New Jersey. This is where we got started in real estate, and well, I actually got started in the property I lived in Philadelphia, but our first real base of operations was Trenton, and we're still headquartered here. We do business up and down the East Coast, North Carolina, fingers crossed on a deal in Kentucky, all over Pennsylvania, and of course, here in our home state of New Jersey, mostly Mercer County here in that. But yeah, this is home for us, and we love it here. Looking forward to being a part of the rebirth and revitalization of the city of Trenton as well.
That's pretty cool. So we're not going to get into how you started. For anyone who wants more of your backstory, I will link to your previous episode, which we did, which was called, if anyone wants to search, Matt Faircloth on Finding, Funding, and Executing Real Estate Investment Projects. But what I want to know is how you have evolved as a real estate investor, as a business collectively. Matt, how have things changed since, February 2016, the last time you were on the show together?
So, well, since then, we've raised our game on raising money. And that's what, that's what we're talking about today, is about raising money from passive investors. We've really focused on bringing in more investors, larger investors, investors that are able to repeat their investments with us over and over again, and kind of raising our flag as a space that people can invest passively. And so because we've done that, we've generated a lot more interest in working with us, which has enabled us to get into larger projects. So since the last time I've been on, we've picked up probably 250 units of residential rentals. Done some really cool fix and flip projects, have done some new construction projects, and so we've been able to get into some really, really interesting spaces that we would be able to do, without the access to more capital. So as you have, we've just raised our game and gotten onto bigger stages.
What single project over that same time period were you most nervous about that felt like you were taking a step in a new direction, you know, that there was maybe some hesitation. And I know, like, you know, we want to play macho and say, oh, none of them. I just had this stuff totally, you know, got the world by the balls here.
Yeah.
If you don't mind being so honest and revealing, which one had you scared that you felt like, you know, looking back, this was a moment of growth for Matt Faircloth. Which deal was that over the last year or so?
Oh, sure. I'll get real with you. We bought a 200-unit apartment complex in North Carolina that doubled our portfolio in one transaction. So it brought in a lot of new things. It was, you know, larger insurance companies came to the deal, larger banks came to the deal, big five-digit attorney bills came to the deal. I'm just doing the math on all the attorney fees we had to pay on that deal. It'll turn your stomach. Just dealing on a larger stage, on a bigger apartment complex like that, and also dealing with a property management company that was going to put staff on site, you know, which I had never done that before. A lot of investors have done, you know, properties with staffed, full-time staff in the building, but we had never done that before. And I love that model. It's great. But we had never done it. And so it was just a lot of newness all around it. What didn't feel, weird or funky or out of place was the raising of the capital, because I knew how to do that. It was just, you know, adding more money to the pot that I needed to bring in. And so that was very comfortable, but just a lot of the other, angles of a big apartment complex like that felt really, you know, felt really new, you know, kind of made me a little nervous, but we got through it, and I'm very grateful we did, because I learned so much, and it really opened us up to new possibilities, and we're now looking at more buildings like that after we've done our first one, which is really exciting.
What is the exit strategy on that 200-unit project?
It's a two-pronged strategy, so we're going to it was a fairly beat-up property, as a lot of properties that are on the market now are. They're just either underperforming or just have some hair on them one way or the other. This property had been mismanaged really, really badly, and so it was low vacancy, lots of deferred maintenance. You know, the guy had just, you know, milked it for everything he could and then was just dumping it. And so what the strategy on that is we're going to get in and we're going to renovate all the units. We're about halfway through that now. And we're going to renovate the exteriors, which we've already done. We dropped in two playgrounds, and that enables us to raise rents. Raising rents enables us to increase value on the property because it all goes down to the bottom line. And that enables us to refinance the property. So first leg of exit is to refinance the property and give investors some of their money back, which increases their rate of return. The next leg is to sell the property between 7 and 10 years into ownership, to generate another cash event, pay investors out, pay ourselves, and move on from there. It's two points of exit.
Gotcha. So there'll be a partial return of capital, I'm assuming maybe 2 years into the ownership once the renovation is done and it's a more stable asset.
Yep.
And then the second leg will be sell at somewhere in 7 to 10 years, hopefully when the market is advantageous to do so. Correct?
That's it. You got it.
Okay. So here's my challenge. And maybe some people on the line have this same challenge too. I personally, and I'm wondering if you went through this at all, I have a lot of people who come to me, have capital to put to work. What I understand, what I'm good at, what Diamond Equity Investments does best is we source a tremendous number of off-market opportunities, and we take down the opportunities that we can get in it and back out of the fastest, with the capital partners, our private money investors that we have already kind of in our network. So I have this model of, you know, a 6 month or maybe a 9 month term private mortgage investment with any one of my private lenders. And that's kind of like our product. That's sort of what we're known for. That's like the comfortable strategy. So me personally, because I haven't been party to the 200 unit project and, you know, go through the refi and the sale, I am a slightly hesitant to kind of put my stamp and my seal of approval on the project. Maybe just because I have not done that yet before. So like that's where I feel like the moment of growth maybe for me would come or should come if I have the time to take a look at that kind of a deal. Because anything, mm-hmm. Matt, when I'm bringing private money to the table, I mean, I don't know how you treat it, but for me, in my mind, I'm guaranteeing those investors something. I'm not, you know, looking to.
Yeah.
I know what the disclosures say in some of these private memorandums that you could lose your investment, a part of it or all of it. But in my mind, that's not an option, and there's no way under any circumstances I would ever want to put someone in that position. So how did you get comfortable
I've made investors whole. I've made investors whole out of my own pocket a few times.
And
I'm the same boat as you, man. They will not lose. Those are my people. I call them my people. So, those are my people that invest with me, and they put me where I'm at, and I'm eternally grateful for having folks that believe in me enough to invest with me. And if something goes awry, I'll make them right. You know, even if I got to go into my own wallet to make it happen. So, anyway, I'm sorry. So your question is, how do you transition into being comfortable with a 200 unit with doing larger apartments like that? Was that because you're under a different model
exact,
right now? You're doing short term.
My exact question for you is, how did you get comfortable with this 200 unit project, underwriting it, et cetera, to put your implicit stamp of approval and or, you know, guarantee, even though we're not allowed to use that word in any of the documents.
Yeah, right. Can't say the G word, right?
No.
So, you know what, Dan? Yeah. I've always been, at my heart, a buy and hold guy. Like, I've always been a landlord. I grew up through landlording. I landlorded myself for many, many years of my portfolio and managed myself, showed a lot of apartments, you know, went to eviction court, you know, did a lot of the hands-on landlording in the business. And because of that, I understand landlording very, very well because I've done it all. You know, unfortunately, I've unclogged toilets and I've done, you know, I've shown apartments and done the whole thing. And so because of that, not just because I've been hands-on in it, because I've been an active landlord in this business, I understand landlording in general. And I think that that's the first step. If somebody wanted to get into a 200 unit apartment building, I don't recommend that be their first. It should be their first, second, third, or fourth deal. I mean, just a rental in general should be their first one.
Right.
That kind of a smaller rental teaches the ropes of the buy. And my guess is you probably got some buy and hold stuff yourself. But if you've got somebody, one of your audience members listening that hasn't done a buy and hold deal yet, if they're just, you know, building up their wholesaling business and grinding it out that way, or if they're doing lots of flips or whatever, the way you work your way up to a 200 unit apartment building is by starting to hold a few assets and then documenting the landlording process for yourself and understanding it, even if you're not a landlord. What does asset management look like? You can't, I mean, nobody I know that owns real estate just never talks to their property manager and never has to do anything, and the checks just show up in their checks just show up in their checking account, and they don't have to interact at all. I wish it was that easy, but it's not. And so just really get engaged in the process of buy and hold, and just it'll start to make sense. Just the 200 unit building is just a larger buy and hold deal. It's just a lot more zeros all the way across the board. So that's what I would say to it.
Cool. The other part of risk that I see in this deal that maybe someone looking in from the outside would also identify would be the construction. So who will actually oversee, complete the renovation of these units there? Is that like a property manager? Is that requiring you to hop on a plane once a month and evaluate things? Just talk about how you address the risk of the construction on this project.
Yeah. So I go down there a lot, just out of just because I want to keep my finger on it and because I think that's just necessary in this business is to be on site and not abdicate. But the property manager that we hired is a large outfit that manages a lot of apartment buildings. And they also have an in-house construction management division to their company. And so we pay them 3% of construction. So if we have a $100,000 bill to put roofs on the property or to renovate a string of apartments, they make 3% of that bill as their CM fee. And so unfortunately, it's not $100,000 to renovate that apartment complex. It's, you know, quite a bit more than that. So they make a nice chunk for managing all that construction. In exchange for that CM fee, they hold all the subcontractors to timeline. They do the day-to-day management. They approve invoices. They write up scopes of work and do the check-ins that, you know, pretty much the owner would be doing if it weren't for them. you know. And so that's who does the construction management. And if you don't have a property manager that's able to do that in house, it'd be much harder to renovate that many units without having the property manager involved in that process. So it's been really great having them in it as opposed to just a third party or trying to do it myself.
How did you find the deal and how did you find the property manager?
So, okay, the CM was easy, or the property manager was easy. They came through my mentor, a buddy of mine that owns a couple of thousand units. I'll be that big one day, but we're not there yet. And so I tend to surround myself with mentors that are, whatever it is they're doing what I want to be doing, and they're doing what I want to be doing on a way larger scale than I am right now. And so I mentor with a guy who owns that many doors, and that's his property manager. And so he gave me his Rolodex, gave me his lawyer, gave me his property manager, gave me a few other folks in his Rolodex, and I was off to the races with his contacts, which was really great because they were all A-class people. We found the property on LoopNet, which is, some people think that's where deals go. I know, right? Some people think that's where deals go to die. I was surprised myself. So I was like, this is on LoopNet? But it was only on LoopNet for a little bit because it went under agreement with another buyer, like immediately after it went on LoopNet, another buyer put it under agreement. I knew the brokerage, and I had bought other properties from the brokerage that had it up for sale. And it was like one of the national commercial real estate brokers. And so I called up my local guy here in Philadelphia, and I said, listen, I see that deal. I like it. I know it just went under agreement, but please keep me close to it. You know, like, let me know you got a buyer if that falls through. And sure enough, that buyer fell through. And so within like 3 days of it falling through, I was on an airplane down there, and I flew down, and they were about to put it back on LoopNet, but never did, because I went down there, and this was, you know, more like not rural North Carolina, but just more laid back North Carolina type of thing. So me and the owner sat down and just drank beers together and closed the deal. Like, just nice. just sat down, and we just told stories and got to know each other. And by the end of it, we just shook hands on the deal, and then off we went, and then had it under contract right there.
That's pretty cool. Is there something you like about, you know, the macro, the market that surrounds this deal, the city, the area, the population, the demographic? What else made this a deal that you were so attracted to?
Well, it's in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and Fayetteville is the home of Fort Bragg, which is the largest military installation in the U.S., and as I understand it, it's also the largest military installation by population in the world. So it is a gargantuan employer in the local area. The current owner had not tapped into the Fort Bragg energy to get that, you know, to get
Wow.
Fort Bragg occupants into his, well, he was blackballed. His concept, that complex was blackballed from Fort Bragg, meaning if you were a Fort Bragg soldier, or a Fort Bragg staff, you weren't allowed to live there because they didn't, call it the commanding officer that's over housing had not approved that complex because it was substandard. And so we've since been able to get it back on the approval list and that, but when we bought it, they were off the list because it was really run down. And so it was in a great location. It was, right at the corner of two major thoroughfares, which, you know, if you were looking for a house to live in, you might not want to live right off a major highway. But if you're looking for an apartment building to live in, you're okay living off a major highway because it's easy to get places from it. You know, it's accessible.
Sure,
and apartment buildings, bigger apartment buildings kind of feel like their own little communities. And so if you can create that community feel, which we did, we put in, you know, like I said, playgrounds and fences and, you know, repainted the complex and all this other kind of stuff. So it feels like its own little microcosm, but it's close to everything. So it becomes a desirable place to live just because of proximity to other stuff. So it's been good. I mean, you know, we had a very high vacancy, which we're in the middle of recovering from high vacancy now and bringing her back out of the hole, so we're not fully optimized yet, but we're on the right path.
What was the vacancy when you bought?
87%.
87% vacant?
Occupied. I'm sorry. I always
get this mixed
up. Is 87% occupied? People say, "What's your vacancy?" And you want to, "What's your occupancy?" No, you're 87% occupied the day that we closed. But the current owner, the prior owner, they had tenants showing on their rent roll that were not actual tenants in the building, if that makes sense. Meaning these were, they had tenants on there that had moved out. And they were gone. They already skipped. Like they were showing as active tenants, but like these people left 3 months ago, you know?
Wow.
And so we had a lot of that. And then we had a lot of tenants that weren't paying, but were still showing as active tenants. And so we had to get a lot of that out. We dropped down to 46% occupancy.
Whoa.
In that. And we're on our way back up from there now. So.
Well, I think we have a great picture of the deal that we're going to now talk about the capital structure behind. So I think this really gives us a good backdrop. So let's talk about the capital structure. What percentage was bank financing? What percentage was a capital raise? And what was offered to the investors on the capital raise to get, you know, to get this thing done?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So we obviously, being at 80%, 87% occupancy at closing, you're not going to qualify for standard mortgages. You know, you're going to have to do something a little creative. And so we got into what's called a bridge loan, which is like it's what you and I would call short term money for like a small single family home deal or a small multi or whatever. Not quite hard money, but not as nice as long term bank financing. So it was an interest-only loan with some construction money loan in there too. So we borrowed part acquisition, part construction. Not a huge LTV because of the condition of the property. They came in at 65% LTV, and that was the best we could do. We ended up taking it, and so they also – but 65% LTV on the purchase price, but they loaned us 100% of the construction. So that was pretty cool. But you know, we had to front the construction, but then get reimbursed with it after. That required us to raise enough to do the other 35% of the purchase price. We bought it for $6.65 million, and we're investing $1.9 million into the property and construction. In that, so total loan amount was around $6 million, and we had to raise about $3.2 in equity. Which that equity raise and that gave us enough money to buy the property, enough operating capital, and gave us closing costs plus we took what's called an acquisition fee, which was a percentage of the purchase price that went to us in exchange for providing this deal to investors, in exchange for doing a lot of the legwork and running around for acquiring the property. And also, you know, I personally guaranteed that loan. Believe it or not, I had to personally guarantee a $6 million loan. So I took an acquisition fee in exchange for that. Investors got 70% of the deal. We got 30%. And on that 70% that investors put up, they'll make, when it's all said and done, they'll make a little over a 16.8% return on their money.
That will be at the end of the 7-year, 10-year hold period, calculated out per annum,
yes.
Right?
You got it. And that's factoring in a sale, too. So that is purchase, cash flow, factor in the effect of cash back at refinance. But I mean, the cash back at refinance is not profit. That's just giving them some of their capital back. So the return is based on how much they've had in the deal blended through the whole time. But yes, it's based on their capital, per annum through their lifetime hold of the deal.
Gotcha. So how much of the $3.2 million in equity would you expect, or did you write into the offering memorandum, to be returned on the refinance?
50%. I think we're going to outperform it, but 50%. Yeah, 50% is what we had out there.
Nice. And then that 16.8%, that's really still calculated using that $3.2 million number, not the reduced number part the way through, right, Matt?
Right. Yeah, it well, yes and no. The way I understand it, again, I have an underwriter that works for me that does all he's my numbers guy. I'm not a numbers guy. I like to look at deals, but I have folks that are smarter than me that run all this. But the way I understand it to be is that IRR is calculated on how much money. So if they are in the deal for, let's say, half the year, it's 2.5, it's a 5-year deal. Let's say for the first 2.5, their full investment's in there. We refinance and return their capital at year 2.5. And their return then after year 2.5 and forward, their return is based on how much they have left in the deal.
Gotcha.
If we return all their money, it's infinite. So that's the way I understand. I could be wrong. you know, and I'm wrong a lot. That's why I surround myself by smart people, Dan. So
yeah, and I'm sure that that's also detailed in the memorandum for sure. So you know that details something
exact,
for it.
Yeah, it gives exact calculations for it. So
yeah, so investors listening to this episode, thinking about putting the money in, you know, this little detail here that I'm digging into, it's important for you to know, you know, the answer to that. So like on our individual loans here, myself, that we do, we typically pay 2 points and 10% interest. But if I only have the money for, say, 5 or 6 weeks, because we literally get in and out sometimes in a matter of 3, 4, 5 weeks on some of the deals, we pay 90 days minimum interest. So if they calculated that, you know, IRR out over a 12-month period, you know, my deals are suddenly producing a 25 or 28% internal rate of return on certain deals by the time you add the origination. So it's important when you're analyzing an investment to participate, if you're thinking about loaning money, to figure out, you know, the velocity of the money. How much is it going to make back in what period of time? And then this could be a really fantastic kicker. Obviously, this deal is no longer on the table, but a fantastic kicker. Let's say you do outperform and your rents are much higher and the appraisal comes in higher, because all of us are conservative when we put together, I would hope all of us are conservative when we put together the offering memorandum. But if you were to refinance and get a much higher valuation, you may be not unreasonable to expect to give back 70 or 80% of the capital on that refi. Right, Matt?
Mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, and all I tell you, the numbers add up quick, Dan. And now, like, if I can get another $100 a month for a renovated unit that I want to head my underwriting, you know, people might look at that and say, "Oh, geez, it's only $100 a month. So what? It doesn't really affect things." Well, hang on for a second. Multiply 100 times 198 units, and then multiply that times 12. You know, you're producing an enormous amount of value for investors if you can get higher than projected rents, which right now we're getting about $175 more than our underwriting said in rents. So that increases the value of that increases the NOI, the bottom line, by about $350,000, give or take. Applied at a 7% cap rate, that's another, say, $4.5 million back in value to investors that we can produce, which is all phenomenal. And so just a few bucks in rent just produces a huge amount. I mean, you don't think about it. And people are like, "Oh, it's only $100. Like, wait, let's run that out and see where that goes. And so I've been able to push my property manager to you know, just push for the high end of the market for rents. They're doing some really aggressive marketing, and it's I think it's going to pay off once we're done.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool deal. I mean, just think about, you know, the long term. It doesn't take a genius, a real estate investor savant, to take a look at the situation and know that, you know, the military installation there is probably not going anywhere. So that would be the biggest risk if, you know, the military pulled out of the town. But, you know, other than that, this is like a recession-proof almost investment. So it should be, from my ignorant perspective, it should be easier to sell this thing once it's stable, once it's up and running, to one of the other larger institutional investors, and for you guys to get out of it 7 to 10 years in, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's a good deal all around.
Cool. All right, let's dig into the cap raise just another few moments here. What was your timeline to raise this money? So you had, you know, a couple beers with the guy, you guys shook hands, and you had 90 days before you got to closing from there?
About 90 days before closing. We ran into a few issues. I mean, you know, just little third-party vendors will slow you down sometimes. So our title company required a survey, and the surveyor took forever to get out there and then to get us his report and everything like that. So that, believe it or not, that surveyor delayed us by like 3 weeks to get to closing in that. So it was about 4 months to close, soup to nuts, from beginning to end. And in that, but that's fine. It's just, you know, a few delays pushed us back a little bit. But for the most part, people should budget somewhere around 90 days at least to close. It just, there's a lot of moving parts to close deals like this. We had the money raised ahead of time, so everybody was ready to roll. A lot of investors had already wired us the funds because we already had everything set up with the LLC set up. They already signed off on subscription agreements. Everything was already in place. So but by the time we took ownership, by the time that we got close to closing, we had all the funds ready to go.
Cool. So what's the minimum investment? And if you could, Mac, give me a play-by-play, maybe with a conversation you might have had, a few objections an investor, or maybe a few questions an investor gave to you,
sure,
that you were able to provide more information in and get that, that investor participated in the end.
Yeah, so I was careful to say in the offer memorandum we had a minimum investment of $100,000. But I also said in there that, you know, the general partner, you know, me and my team, had the right to, had discretion to waive that $100,000 if we chose to. What that enabled us to do was it enabled us to just to kind of weed out people that would only want to put in like $5,000-$10,000 into the deal, because you really can't move the needle with that if you're raising $3.2 million. Additionally, those people should probably hang on to their capital, build their pool up a little further before they go getting into passive investments like this. You want people that have a good amount of expendable cash, not sure what to do with it, you know, sick and tired of Wall Street, whatever it is. And so our average investment was $75,000. And we had some investors that put in, we have one investor at $550,000 and a few in the multiple six-figure range, and that's, but it averaged out around 75 to 100. Typical conversation for investors, what we would do is we sent out, we have an email list that investors can sign up. You can sign up for our email list at DeRosaGroup.com. And we just emailed our database and said, hey guys, listen, we've got a deal. This is what it looks like. We just sent out what we call a flyer that just gives the basics of the deal, unit count, investments that we're looking for, what we project the IRR to look like. And, you know, investors would just sign up for a webinar, and then we would do a webinar, you know, webinar, and we would just present the OM in a PowerPoint format. And I would just go through the deal. Okay, here's why North Carolina. Here's why Fayetteville. Here's why that location right there. Here's their current rents. Here's what their rents are going to look like. That whole conversation I just went through with you on the rent bump, we went through with them in the PowerPoint by saying, like, okay, this is where the market is. And we showed them a little scatter chart map of all the rents all around the complex, all of which is all public information. It's all right there online. So we just consolidated all of it and put it in a chart. And show them, this is where the market is in rents, this is where we are, this is the gap that we're going to close. Once we do that, this is the value we're going to create. We went down there and toured those complexes ahead of time, so I had actual photos and marketing material from those complexes that I showed people to say, hey, listen, here's the finishes that they did, here's what our cost is going to be to recreate that, and also how to make ours a little more unique than theirs. So put all that together in a business plan, and then, of course, a financial statement that my underwriter produced that showed the nuts and bolts, showed them 10 years. Like, if we were to hold the building 10 years out, we showed them a full 10-year hold profit and loss statement in that. Just, you know, got into the numbers with them a bit. It's funny, most investors don't want to get into the numbers too much. You're curious about what the overall return is going to look like, but they're more curious. Average investor question is, what if Fort Bragg closes? You know, you know, stuff like that. You know, what if this, what if that, you know, who's the property manager? Have you vetted them out? More logistics on the deal and more logistics on worst case scenario, right? And less about, well, what if you come in at 15% versus 16%? Or what if what if that, what if that? Questions about my leadership team, you know, who's running this property, who's going to be doing this, and what are you going to be doing in the day-to-day, you know, me as in that side of it. So a lot of the questions were about logistics. So a lot of the questions, too, were about if they're investing with cash, asking me to go over the tax benefits that they would get through their cash investment, which I went deep into. Some folks were investing with IRAs because a lot of our investors have self-directed IRAs. So they wanted us to get into that or how does that work? And so I would educate them on how a self-directed IRA works, and here's the custodian I use. Here's how they would handle it, everything like that. So, yeah, and it's less conversation on the numbers than investors would think that it is. But it's less that and more logistics and a lot of basic stuff. Like, how'd you get started, Matt? You know, like, tell us your backstory. Tell us, you know, tell us all about you personally, because they want to make sure they can trust me and my company. So that's where a lot of it. The conversation is not on the numbers. It's more along those kinds of things.
Yeah, you're right about that. It's a common theme that comes up with people raising capital, Matt. It's, you know, we bet on the jockey, not the horse. You know, a lot of the Silicon Valley founders are, you know, seeking investment, receiving investment because of who they are and their abilities and, you know, the credibility of them as an operator. Same way it is for you, same way it is for me. I noticed when I invest in my money into other people's projects or even into my own team members' projects, you know, we have a variety of people around the country, and there comes a moment where I have to ask myself. I have the phone picked up. I have my wiring instructions pulled up on the screen. And, you know, I'm asking myself, hey, I'm getting ready to wire over $50, $60, $70, $80,000, whatever the amount is to fund the investment. Like, do I trust this person who sent the wiring instructions mm-hmm. over implicitly? Yes, there's documentation. Yes, there's, you know, mortgages and notes and those kind of things. But, you know, I'm not going to lend money and I'm not going to, you know, green light the wire unless I feel like I can, you know, fully trust that person. As long as, you know, sometimes I have to give myself that push. Okay, yeah, I trust this person. I've been doing business. We closed out, you know, $1.3 million in deals over the last 2 years. It's good and the right thing for me to pull the trigger and fund this deal. But, like, I know that mm-hmm. investors on the flip side are also having that same moment when they fund my deals. They have to, you know, they feel comfortable. Some of them at this point, you know, it's a text message. There's not even an offering memorandum. Hey, I need, you know, 80,000. Okay, great. Here it is, Dan. Send the wiring instructions. I haven't talked to the guy in 4 months. He's funded like 9 deals of mine so far. But then on the flip side, like you're talking about, you know, a lot of these people, it sounds like from the communications that you had during your webinars, you put in a tremendous amount of work. The webinar strategy, hats off. What a fantastic way to organize your information. Get the Q&A of more than one person's perspective at the same time on a webinar. So you're really able to like leverage your presentation and your time there. I think that's a really commendable and important thing for anyone wanting to raise money, or especially for a large capital raise. The webinar strategy is perfect. So yeah, I think you did a really good job, and it sounds like a lot of the people were doing business with you for the first time through that strategy with some of the questions you ran into, you know, the IRAs and whether it was cash and mm-hmm. investment. So it's cool. I'm sure they felt the same way that I feel having to, you know, okay, now it's time. We're going to send this money over to Matt and we're going to buy this apartment.
Fingers crossed, right? Man. Yeah, yeah, I'm in the same boat, but I've done the same thing you did where I was like, okay, let me go and write a big check to this person and, you know, and I'm going to vet them out and make sure I can trust them and make sure that, you know, just make sure everything smells right and all that. But there is a certain moment where you're like, all right, I guess I got to just have faith and send this off and have faith that it's going to work out and have faith in my judgment that that this person is going to do the right thing. I'm sure that my investors go through the same thing. And as going all the way back to the beginning of the conversation, you know, I don't discount the faith that they have in me to do right by them and all that. And I don't discount that hold their breath moment where they put their finger over the enter key and I'm like, I don't want to do this. Okay, fine, I'll do it. You know, yes, I trust Matt. Yes, I trust Dan. Yeah. Whatever it is, like, fine, I'll fire it. Because I've been in those shoes. I have, and so I get a certain level of just connection and a certain level of just okay, I'm trusting my financial wherewithal with this person. I don't lose sight that these are their retirement accounts or the money they're going to send their kids to college with, or you know, their inheritance that their parents worked really hard to create for them and they want to build a legacy for their kids with it or something like that. I mean, whatever it is, I don't discount that. I'm not saying people do, but I think it's possible that you could, and I do not. So I get it.
So, Matt, in conclusion to our capital raise on the 198-unit project in Fayetteville, what question did I forget to ask, or what important points do you think need to be made before we move on from here?
Yeah, I think that as cool and hot and sexy of a project as that is, I think that I don't want your listeners to lose sight of putting one foot in front of the other. And it's not about that deal. It's not like, oh, geez, okay, I want to be like Matt and go out and buy a 200-unit apartment building, or be like Dan and have this gargantuan network across the U.S. that I'm working and everything like that. It's about putting one foot in front of the other and understanding your business and the real estate business enough that you could explain it to a fifth grader. Because and the reason why you should be able to do that is because you should be able to explain what we do, what real estate investors do to potential investors with you that know nothing about real estate. People like real estate investors like you and me tend to only hang out with real estate investors, so we tend to speak jargon and tend to get too used to talking real estate talk. But I suggest that people try explaining this business to people that have no hand at all in real estate. And I think that on a small scale, just people all around you that may want to invest, if you make it simple and easy, and you can start by getting an investor in on a two family with you, or a four family or whatever. My book talks about how to start really, really small. I'm not someone that thinks that people should start with a 200 unit complex. I know that there's, you know, gurus out there that'll tell you that that's what you should be doing. I don't agree with them. I think that you should start small and quickly work your way up if you want. So I want to make sure your listeners hear that although this is a cool project, it doesn't have to be the first, second, third, or fifth project that people get themselves into. They can start small and work their way up. And there's people all around them that have money that are willing to put it into their deals that like and trust them perhaps and want to make an alternative return on their money. So
that's a really great point, Matt. I remember struggling myself, you know, and always thinking like, if I could raise private money, that would be the answer. You know, if I had Matt DeRosa's contacts and could put together, I would do the 200 unit deal and all that, you know, like a while back. And I know that's a commonly held misconception for a lot of people, like, oh, I need the cash, I need the lender, I need the wealthy funder so that I can go flip houses and do business. But Mark Cuban said it best. Mark Cuban said, focus on building the best possible business that you can, and the opportunities will appear. People will notice, and you will, become a magnet for greater opportunities. And I remember like seeing that, and I put it on my vision board on my wall. You know, I tore a picture, printed off the internet, however I did, taped it to my wall, and I'd wake up and stare at that every day. And, you know, this is, you know, a while back, nobody wanted to invest in the deals. And the only way I could get, you know, people to participate in my deals at the time was I would dig up the deals, and they were, you know, it was a $6,000 house in, like, you know, outside of Philadelphia, some little like one bedroom cottage. And we flipped that, and I brought in an equity partner. So like somebody funded the deal, put the money up for the construction, the purchase, et cetera. And we did a 50-50 split on that deal. You know, within a few months, I had, you know, the 10 and 12% interest lenders, and I had partners on deals. And before I knew it, you know, it's more deals than I could count. And all of a sudden, you know, I improved my business. I built the company. I figured out how to do marketing. I figured out how to present myself and my opportunities to other people around me in a more effective, you know, method, being able to communicate about the business the same way that you talk about to somebody outside the business, and, you know, all in ways that did eventually attract more and more opportunities to myself. So I started small, to your point. You know, I still feel like I'm doing small things, even though it's, you know, it's big numbers, and I am very grateful for the growth we've had. But yeah, man, that beginning.
But it's all about that small deal. It's about that first deal. It's so funny. Your first deal was almost exactly like my first deal. Like it was, you know, guy put up 50K and we went 50-50 on two single family homes that I did all the sweat equity on. He put up all the money. I did all the sweat. And we did well on these two little single family homes, you know, right here in Trenton, in that. But because of that deal, I then had a track record. I had a deal that I could point to. He told a few of his friends about it, you know, and it was kind of off to the races from there, but it's really about getting that first deal done to your listeners, to getting the first equity deal done or investor deal done. And they just tend to domino after that. And people always want, like, they want the big, hot, sexy deal. They want, like, the 200-unit apartment building or whatever. But then you got to hear that deal will come. Maybe not tomorrow, but just do what's in front of you, the small deal now, and it'll snowball quick up to the big stuff.
Agreed. So, Matt, do you have any, you know, recent book recommendations? You talked a little bit about one that you put together that you could share with the listeners.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, we've got my book briefly. It's called Raising Private Capital. They can hear more about it at my website, derosagroup.com. And I wrote the book for Bigger Pockets as my publisher. Books for I'm in the middle of a book. My wife already finished it. She put it on my desk. A book called Traction. which is a phenomenal book for it's maybe not a book for somebody just getting started in real estate or for in business, but it is a great book for somebody who's got a few years under their belt and is looking to take their business from here to there, right? That wants to take it and scale it and build systems and create a process and that now enables them to like 10x their business. So Traction is a phenomenal book that I'm almost done with, and I'm already implementing a bunch of stuff that I'm learning from it.
Is that Gino Wickman?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah, we've heard that a few times. I have that on my list, on my bedside table. Haven't cracked that one yet, so I appreciate that.
Are you like me? I got like 8 books on my bedside table right now. You must be like me, because my wife makes fun of me that my bedside table literally has like all these books that people send me or that I pick up in the bookshop. Like, oh yeah, I want to read that. And she's like, why don't you finish reading what you got? I'm like, well, I want to, you know, these are just reminding me that I got to get some reading done. So
yeah, I figured out another solution. I went out and got a nice like 3-drawer bedside table, so I could just put them in the drawers and not have to look at them anymore.
Yeah, there you go. I got to do that. Yeah.
Just kidding. I do read a lot. I read a lot of books. Spend a lot of time on Audible, as everybody I'm sure who's listening to the show hears me talk about often. It's been key to, you know, I read my way out of poverty, and I suggest anybody in that situation could do the same, or even to a better tomorrow, even if, you know, you're not starting from where I did. So, Matt, let me ask you this final question here. If you could go back to your younger self, like when you found that first capital partner and bought those first 2 houses in Trenton, what were you, like 22, 23? How old were you when you did that?
No, I was 20. I did my very first real estate deal when I was 26.
Okay.
That private investor deal was probably, I was maybe 35. In that. So it was about half. I'd done a lot. I built my business on my own with my own capital for the first probably 5 years, and then brought in investors once we couldn't do that anymore. We wanted to expand. So, so you want to know what I would tell my younger self before I got really going in this business, right?
What would be the crown jewel of wisdom you'd share with your 25, 26 year old self when you're just starting out?
I would say have really good goals and stay focused on them, and don't let yourself get shaken off, because I was one that many of your listeners may be able to relate to, that got excited and about other like shiny pennies that may have showed up. And so, to the person that has never thought about apartment building is now listening to you and I talk about them and is like, okay, I'm going to go buy an apartment building. Don't do that. Don't do that. You know, unless it's in your goal set and your 5-year plan, the real success I've seen in my life has only come from sticking to my plan and not allowing, you know, things to shake me off of that. And I've wasted a lot of time getting into things that did not concern, were not on my plan, but just seemed like a good idea at the time. So yeah, I would say stick to, you know, set really good goals and then just stick to them and don't allow the day-to-day noise to shake you off of it.
Well said. So, Matt, if anyone wants to, you know, get in touch with you, your company, do you have some information or a place they can go to get in touch with you?
Yeah, we got a phenomenal website out there called at derosagroup.com. That's DEROSA group, GROUP.com. Folks can hear all about what we're up to as a company. They can sign up for a mailing list. They can hear more about investments we have to offer as well. They can also pick up a copy of my book, and they can check out all these social media outlets we have with our YouTube channel and some other cool stuff that we have available too. So just go to derosagroup.com and you'll see everything there is to know about us.
Cool. I really appreciate your transparency in sharing all the details, all the numbers, all the little nuances that we could, at least in a 40-minute or so our time together here. But I appreciate you closing the door and taking time to be here with the REI Diamond Show listeners, Matt.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a real pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next episode. We have our returning guest and U.S. economist, Paul Sloat, coming on with the quarterly market update, where he provides a registered investment advisor's perspective on what is going on in the U.S. and around the world that could potentially impact the value of the real estate you are investing in right now. You won't want to miss that one. If you are interested in a pre-release of the next episode before the email goes out, please subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. For those who'd prefer the email notification, and if you'd also like to check out a free PDF download of my book, Become a Wholesale Real Estate Master, please go to reidiamonds.com. Interested in getting in touch with me? If you have a deal for sale, or maybe you'd like to suggest a guest to come on the show, you can always reach out to me directly through reidiamonds.com. I am always buying houses, so I am always looking for deals in Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, Miami, and Tampa. So if you have a deal, preferably one that I can fix and flip for a profit, please send it over, reidiamonds.com. Also at that site, you can check out the available profitable real estate deals I may have for sale in your market there, and the entire archive of the REI Diamond Show, totaling more than 118 content-rich, money-making, idea-packed episodes. Accredited investors are currently earning double-digit returns passively in real estate. Are you? You can sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunities. They are double-digit return opportunities via email by going to superchargedreturns.com. Thanks again, my loyal listener, for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.